In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Stories of three species disappearing from South Dakota. From SDPB, today is Thursday, September 5th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, meet a tiny shorebird along the mighty Missouri. The piping plover struggled through summer storms. A dedicated scientist takes us into the heartbreak as he documented the devastation. Then we'll peer through the netting around the Great Plains Zoo's hoop house pots. Two biologists talk about the vanishing Dakota skipper and the prairie ecosystem going with it. Plus, a fish that survived the mass extinction of the dinosaurs and is struggling to survive in the human-altered habitat that now threatens its existence. We'll head to Gavin's Point to meet the pallid sturgeon later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to start today with a threatened species who's only in South Dakota for a few months out of the year. The piping plover, or plover, comes to the state for the same reason many people do. They're here to settle down, build a home, start a family. But there isn't much real estate left for the plover to do that. Plus, sometimes plovers lose their nests and their children and their lives in bouts of severe weather or because of human encroachment. Galen Johns is a natural resource specialist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
It's primarily habitat loss, and you'll see that with almost all threatened and endangered species. It's impacts to their habitat. You know, these birds are hunted back in the 19th century, early 20th century for their plumage. That impacted the population some, but it was really people moving in, developing, building houses next to rivers and next to beaches that really impacted these birds. And here on the Missouri River, we built dams to control the flooding. Those dams really impacted the birds' habitat on the river.
Because they need the sandbar. They need the river sandbar, right?
Yes, they like large open areas of sand. They look like the sand. Their nests look like the sand. If they see a predator coming from a distance away, they can get off the nest. They'll go up to the predator, act like they have a broken wing, and draw that predator away from the nest. And when the sand goes away, we get smaller areas of sand out there. It's much easier for the predator to get the jump on the bird in the nest.
Do we have a sense of how many there were? How much has been lost?
We have a pretty good idea of how much habitat has been lost.
Yeah.
And it is a lot on the Missouri. Anywhere we have reservoirs, any potential sandbars out there are flooded. And where we don't have reservoirs, the flows in the river are very controlled. And when you control those flows, you don't get the dynamic alteration of sandbars from year to year, which is what these birds rely on. You get sandbars remaining in the same place year to year. They grow up with vegetation, and that gives the predators more cover to come up on these birds.
So in the past, part of what you've talked to us about is removing that vegetation around this time of year, you know, up around Labor Day. How is this year different?
Our habitat removal program is ongoing. It's just one of the things that we are able to control, and we can control that from year to year, help eliminate vegetation on the sandbars. One thing we cannot control is the weather, and the weather had a pretty good impact on the birds here this year, especially in southeast South Dakota. We had a pretty big hailstorm event near Elk Point, South Dakota on May 20th. And that hailstorm killed 40 adult piping plovers and their nests destroyed with the bad hailstorm.
Say that and again. It killed how many?
40 adults.
Wow.
And destroyed their nests. And this is my 20th year doing this work, and that was the worst devastation I've seen from a single storm event. And if that wasn't bad enough, a month later, around June 20th, we had some pretty significant rainfall events in southeast South Dakota. A lot of locals here will remember that. We had flooding on the Jim River, flooding on the Vermilion River, and those rivers feed into the Missouri, and it created flooding on the Missouri River. The Missouri River came up several feet, actually inundated a lot of the sandbars where these birds had nests, and it washed away a lot of nests. Over 100 nests got flooded, and even more chicks than that had gotten washed away. They had already hatched, but they couldn't fly yet. So very devastating impacts from the weather this summer. And it'll take a couple of years to for the birds to recover from that.
Yeah. Tell me what your day was like then, the day after the hailstorm, the days that the floods were coming. What was your job? What kind of action were you able to take? Where were your hands tied? Tell me a little bit about that time.
Yes, with the hailstorm, it was gut-wrenching going out there, seeing the impacts. We needed to get out there and document how many birds were killed. We needed to do that right away because predators can get out there and scavenge some of those bird carcasses. If we don't get out there right away and count them, we might not know how many were missed. Mm. So we had to do that right away, and yes, that was not fun. And then with the rainfall event, that happened very quickly. We had about a two-day notice that the river was going to really flood, and not much we could do in that time. And when the floodwaters hit, it really wasn't safe to be out on the river, at least the lower part of the river, mm-hmm. down around Vermilion, Elk Point, Ponca, Nebraska. There's a lot of water coming down the river, but there's a lot of debris coming with it, logs floating down. So I have crews that go out there and help survey these birds, and we didn't even go out in the lower river just for safety's sake. Yeah. So it was a couple of days before we got out there.
Well, I'm sorry that is not what a scientist wants to be out doing, is documenting devastation and loss. That's a terrible day.
We need to document so we know what's happening out there.
Let's talk about what recovery looks like. How many of these birds are there, and what are some of the efforts to bring them back further? I mean, help me understand the numbers.
Okay, so we have roughly, on the Atlantic coast, there are roughly 4,000 birds in the breeding population. On the Great Plains, we think we are close to that. We don't, sheer number-wise, we don't see that many birds, but we have much greater fluctuations here in the population. Some years we have less, some years we can produce quite a few more birds. All told, we have probably around 8,000 breeding adults throughout the U.S., and there are always some birds out there that aren't breeding yet. They're bachelor birds, we call them, birds that are too young to breed yet. So the population, we think, across the nation is somewhere around 12,000 birds.
How hard is it to get attention for the plight of the plover, to get people to understand the role of conservation efforts?
People do care. We find that the more we educate them about the birds, the more they support our program, they support what we're doing out there, trying to help out these birds. You know, most people think of birds, they think of birds nesting in trees in their backyard, things like that. Mm-hmm. They don't think about these shorebirds that nest out there in the middle of a sandbar, just make a little bowl in the sand, lay their eggs, and that's where they sit and incubate those eggs for 4 weeks. A lot of people don't know about that. They don't realize that. People might go out on sandbars, not know those birds are there. Again, they're very hard to see. And just by being present on a sandbar, you can keep adults off the nest, and that can cause the nest to go bad.
Sure.
The adults might abandon the nest. If it's hot or rainy or windy, that nest can go bad very quickly. if the adult is not tending to it. So we put up signs when we find these birds nesting out there in the sandbars. We put up signs and we tell people, hey, we have threatened and endangered birds nesting here. Please stay out of the area. We don't even want you landing your boat on a sandbar because that could disturb the birds to the point where they abandon the nest. That's the same as if a predator had gotten the nest. It's take. We try very hard to educate people on where these birds are nesting and why we're trying to protect them. They were here long before we were.
How do they tie into the ecosystem as a whole? Why do they matter as a species?
Well, one way to look at it is it's not just these birds that are in trouble. There are a lot of other species of fish and wildlife that are in trouble along the river because we've impacted the flows on the river. Turtles are a great example. Turtles nest on these sandbars also. You have less sandbar habitat out there. The turtle populations are dwindling. The soft-shell turtle has been listed on the state threatened and endangered sites. In a sense, we can think of the piping plover as the canary in the coal mine. If you're familiar with that adage, it's where the coal miners would carry a canary in the coal mine with them, and the bird would pass out from, I believe it's carbon monoxide poisoning. That would serve early warning to the miners to get the heck out of that mine. We have the same thing going on here. These critters are in trouble. We need to figure out why, and if we don't do something, that could eventually impact us down the road.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A zoo is not always a quiet place.
I'm talking to this bird over here.
At the Great Plains Zoo in Sioux Falls, near the carousel and the splash pad, between the petting zoo and the penguins, producers Ellen Kester, Ari Youngerman, and I were welcomed into a zoological oasis. We toured the hoop house, and within its curved mesh walls, we learned about a desperate scientific venture, the recovery of a tiny prairie pollinator. Biologists Jenna Hongus and Colton Ekstrand are working to save the Dakota Skipper.
What we're standing in right now is our hoop house. So it's a very simple thing. It looks like any standard hoop house you would see at like a garden show or a thing like that. It has a nice black mesh. That mesh that's covering everything, the main goal of that is to keep out bugs from our wonderful little caterpillars.
So overall, our ultimate goal long term is to get the endangered Dakota Skipper butterfly repopulated and released out into native tall grass prairies. Now, we are not even close to that end goal yet. We are, I would say, smack dab in the middle.
We started first contacting the Minnesota Zoo. They're the guys who pioneered working with Dakota Skippers and the other endangered species, the Powashiek. So they really were the pioneers of all of this, and we started working with them in about 2021. 2022 is when our hoop house here got built. It's when all of the setting, all of the netting got put up, when concrete got put in, and when we started prepping and buying everything we needed. And 2023 is when we first went out into the field. We got everything set up. So we went out in the field and we found the adults, that little tiny, about 1 inch wingspan butterfly. And then we took those back in here. We kept them with us. We collected their eggs and then we raised the caterpillars. So we've set up a bunch of tall grass prairie pots. They're about 1 gallon pot. And then it grows easily up to about 2 to 3 feet tall. And we keep the caterpillars on that grass for an entire year cycle. So when we do that, that's the next step, is we brought in the caterpillars, we put them on the tall grass, we set them up, and we've been raising them for the year. We have successfully raised out our first generation of tawny-edged skippers. That's our test species. And we are in our second generation attempting to scale up to see how much work it will be of that tawny-edged. And once we have those two, with those two test years behind us, then we can start working and beginning to prep to work with the Dakota skippers. The Tawny Edge and the Dakota skippers are very similar butterflies. They have a lot of the same needs. And as you can imagine, working with an endangered species often has a lot of background and paperwork and a lot of difficulties and a lot of testing that goes into it. So we bring in the Tawny Edge to prove our entire system works before we bring in an endangered species and do any risks of damaging them in the wild.
So when you're going out to the field, as you said, to try to identify, are you looking for the Tawny or are you looking for the Dakota skipper in the field? And how do you find any of them? Because that sounds like a challenge in and of itself.
Finding the skippers proved to be much harder than we imagined. So that takes us to 2023, late June, early July. We went out into the field, and by into the field, we're looking for tall grass prairies. We went right around the Millbank area, and we went with Dennis Skadsden. So he is a butterfly specialist. And I would say he's the skipper guy for Northeast South Dakota. He was fabulous in taking us out and showing us not only the sites that he has looked at for years and years and has historical data on what types of skippers were seen in these spots, but also we were able to net these live butterflies, look at them in tiny jars, and be able to show the little tiny dots we were looking for versus not looking for, to make sure we were able to identify the correct type, but also then find gravid or pregnant females. And so, as most conservation projects go, it definitely flopped the first few times. We went out into the field with little to no luck. We found one male in the first few field days, and we just kept looking and looking. Even with the Tawny Edge skippers, we were getting a max of 15 females back, and that's really it. So these numbers are very, very small. When we are looking for them, we're not looking for a butterfly soaring across the sky. We're looking more of that pinging grasshopper type of flight pattern that is really focused towards nectaring plants like the purple coneflower. So echinacea flower is the main source for these guys. Really, we didn't find them in much shade because they cannot see when it's shady, because they only see UV light. So if it's cloudy, if it's shady, if it's rainy, all of these things mean no butterflies. So it was quite a challenge to get out and find those. As of recently, we have found a site around the Brookings area. So still quite a trek for us from Sioux Falls to go out, find those, and bring them all the way back. But we are making it work. It just shows you how much the tall grass prairie has declined in the last 40 years.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. This is a habitat loss situation that causes the numbers to drop like they have?
Yeah, so when you think about the tall grass prairie, we all imagine it as like long rolling fields of beautiful tall grasses, and everything is filled with the occasional coneflowers and things like that. While that's the perception, and it is all still in one big land area, the difficulty is it's much better to think about these as tiny little islands. So you'll have a small few acres of still prairie grasses, still rolling grains, and then it'll be surrounded by fields of crops and towns and roads. And when we're working with Dakotas and all skippers in general, they really only fly maybe about 7 feet for the entirety of their life. They'll be born, they'll caterpillar on one tiny little section of grasses, and when they become an adult, the maximum they're flying is about 20 feet. They do that tiny little pinging things, and 20 feet, it sounds really small for all of us, but remember, these guys are about an inch, right? So they're even 7 feet, there still could be a lot of them in that area generally. But the difficulty is, That means with these tiny little sections of isolated prairie, the skippers can't go from section to section. They just can't make it. It's not like a monarch or a gulf literary that's able to actually fly in the air and get to these different sections. So if one little island of prairie has its Dakota skippers wiped out, there's nothing coming back to replace it. In the old time, back when the prairie was all combined, if a section had its population wiped out, they would slowly move back in. But we have broken that ability up by breaking up the prairie as we have. So,
are there landowners and producers you're in partnership with it? When we talk about land and some of the places that the butterfly might still live, how are you working with people in South Dakota to have them aware that this endangered species might be part of your operation if you're in agriculture?
Yeah, so Dennis really cued us into a lot of that. Again, there comes the political side of it and getting permits, getting permission to look in certain areas to cross on land safely and with permission of a landowner. So Dennis knows and is affiliated with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and did have access to some of that land. He also knew a couple farm owners with land that allowed him to look on those lands. We have since contacted SDSU in order to get onto Oak Lake Field site outside of Brookings, which is a preserve that they use for a lot of their classes. And so that is a very important part of it. Again, networking is super important. What's cool about Oak Lake Field site is it has allowed us to go into a virtually undisturbed, quote unquote, prairie that SDSU itself is trying to restore back to its native stance. And so making sure it has natural fire clearing, making sure it has little to no disturbance besides the student studies on that area.
All right, can you show us what you're doing here?
Yeah, so what you're seeing here is you're seeing our grass pots. So each of them is a gallon pot. It's holding, generally where, how these have been set up is there's like 4 to 5 sprouts of the drop seed in it that have been allowed to grow for several years. You can see around in the hoop house, we have some that have been clearly eaten back and are smaller shrubs. Those ones were probably used in the last year because our little caterpillars, even though we only keep about 5 caterpillars on each any of these gallon pots, are able to eat down basically the entire gallon over the course of a year if they're really determined. Caterpillars do basically nothing but eat. That's their whole little goal in life. So what you're seeing with this is we have, right now we have 10 pots set up. Each of these has between 4 to 5 caterpillars on it. And these will be left basically alone for the next few months. All we do is we water the grasses, but we don't actually water the pots themselves. Underneath them, we have a capillary mat. It's meant to hold water. And all of the pots suck in their water up there, and then we lightly mist the top. This is to avoid things like accidentally drowning butterflies. So the caterpillars, when they first hatch, are about half the width of a grain of rice. So take a grain of rice, cut it in half the long way. That's how thick they are, and they're only maybe a little bit longer than that. They're very, very tiny when they first come out. So if you can imagine, even a drop of water, like a full raindrop, could be dangerous to them. So that's why we also have this setup of netting around all of our pots. The pots, this netting keeps out other pests, the big ones being spiders and ants. And it also makes it so that the water comes in smaller little raindrops to keep it safe for them. So they'll stick in here, and then once winter comes around, just after the first frost, so that's normally right around the start of October, we'll break down the tomato cages that are in each of the pots, and then we will set them, we will let their mesh crumple down, the actual plant itself, and we'll prepare for winter. In the wild, these guys would overwinter basically just buried under the snow. The snow, much like an igloo does, the snow in the wild, the underneath of the snow is actually slightly warmer than above the snow. And these guys are able to make something akin to an internal antifreeze. So when that winter comes in, they make their antifreeze, they burrow up in a little hovel they make for themselves, and then they just let the snow fall on them. So we attempt to emulate that as much as possible. We break this down by still giving them a netting to make sure ants and stuff don't get to them. But we do, in fact, when the snow comes, we plop snow right on top of them. We want to make sure they are completely buried. And then once next spring, they'll reemerge. They'll continue eating as caterpillars. And then they'll finish out their life cycle and emerge as adults somewhere in the neighborhood of around July 4th. And then once they've emerged as that, they're only adults for around 2 weeks. And then the whole cycle goes again.
Incredibly vulnerable sounding.
They're a very unique species in the fact that they are caterpillars for about 11 months and really only butterflies for a couple weeks. I think it's just a miracle of nature that they can make it through our harsh winters as tiny as they are. Now, keep in mind, this caterpillar full grown is less than an inch long.
Can we see any? Are they here? I'm not seeing them. Am I supposed to see them?
That is a great question. No. I mean, if we were to spend hours and hours digging and piecing out every single piece of this grass, we might find one of our 45. But really, it's not easy or recommended to look for them. Now, we just don't want to disturb their life cycle portion that they're at. And especially once it gets towards winter, they're building their little kind of semi-temporary habitats down in the base of those grasses. So every time somebody walks by and goes, "How are the skippers?" And we go, "We don't know." So it's very much a conservation project, right? Why with the you hope and you do everything you can, and the rest is really up to nature. Mm.
So you have to trust as a scientist that the best thing to do is to not disturb what's already happening, what you have set up for.
And that is the hardest part. Yes.
Now, have you already been through a cycle of this where they emerged?
Yeah, so we're into the second year. We've already had 1 year of emergence. That was back around July. So we started last year, we had around 43 caterpillars that we had started the entirety of the process with. These numbers are going to sound a little strange, but I can explain how normal some of them are. At the end, right before we put them into what's called diapause. Diapause is before they go into winter. We went down to about 15. So we went down from around 40 to around 15. That's very standard with caterpillars.
And we did do a census.
Yeah.
Kind of like you said, can you see them? Now, we didn't want to go through a whole year of trying to care for these things if they had already passed away. And so, because it was our first year, we did do a census. We did take every single piece of grass to look for and count those just to make sure we were doing the right thing to even get them to that stage.
And that we won't do that again this year, because every time we go in and we do that, we disrupt their little house. They make their little home, they want to live in it, and every time we mess with it, they kind of throw a hissy fit and they decide they want to make a new one. So they go off, they waste a bunch of energy making a whole new little home, and they wrap themselves in a tiny little silk ball. So every time we do that, we've stressed the animal out. And with the conservation program, we want to avoid it. The first year, it was very important to test the program. This year, we won't do it. So as I was saying, when we got when we went down to 15 from about the 40, that's fairly normal. Insects don't have a great survival program generally. And then over winter, we went down from about 14 down to about 12. That was great numbers to survive through the winter. We were really, really happy with that. Diapause is much like hibernation is for bears. There's always some sort of danger with it. Hibernation is a very dangerous process. Basically, if you put any biological program on pause for any period of time, it can do some damage to them. There's always a risk they don't wake up. So when we got them out, they came, we had about that many. And then by the end, we had 9 that had survived the entire process and had pupated. And we had about 5 of them emerge as full adults. So from about 40 at the start all the way to 5 at the end. So you can imagine when we want to do the Dakota Skipper program, right now we have about 10 pods. In the future, when you want to make a big scale effort, you're going to need somewhere around 500 pods, because you're going to need hundreds of these individuals released into the wild to actually get them at a substantial number. We're a testing program right now, and we're scaling it up to see how much effort it is. But places like the Minnesota Zoo and its partners for its programs have multiple hoop houses where they're just pot on pot on pot of caterpillars that are getting raised up.
What gives you optimism? And what causes you to despair a little bit?
Optimism definitely comes when we look at the Minnesota Zoo. We look at their program. We look at how much it has scaled up and how they've been able to pass it on to us. What's really difficult, both optimism and a little bit of a setback, is going out into the field. We've had days where we're completely like nothing. We saw nothing. We spent hours in the beating sun looking for these tiny things and nothing. And then we'll have days where we're just thrilled to bring back 10. And people are like, 10? Yes, 10. And this isn't even the endangered species yet. But we have found a ridiculous amount of things that have tried to hold us up. And we've been very, very persistent with the assistance of our conservation director, Stephanie, of plugging through and finding ways around those difficulties, whether it's just getting a water source close to our location, just finding the prairie drop seed, this specific grass that the caterpillars eat. This is their host plant that they do best on. For a long time, we couldn't buy it. We could not buy it from any place at maturity of 3 years without it having a pesticide, which, fun fact, if you want to grow an animal that eats grass, you can't have pesticide on it. And so exactly making our point even further that habitat loss and pesticides are a huge issue for these guys, we really had to go through different loopholes. We've been super grateful for everyone who's helped us out. The Minnesota Zoo has answered a ton of questions. They have also really just plowed through the first few, really the first decade of this project for us, and allowed us to piggyback off of the immense amount of things that they learned. If we're finding things that are holding us up, I can only imagine the things they found to hold them up, because we are literally taking their project and duplicating it here. So we've been super grateful. We did end up not only finding a source for these pots at a very expensive rate, but we did partner with Augustana, the local college, and some of the faculty there and students were able to raise some of the grasses by seed in their greenhouse over the summer. Now, we were only able to get about 20 to 30 1-gallon pots from that, but we have to remember it takes 3 years for those to even reach maturity. So there are tons and tons of things that you don't think about. You're like, yeah, catch a butterfly, raise the caterpillars, and there's just so much more that goes into it than that.
Hope and despair, what would you add to that from your perspective?
So hope is we succeeded. That was the biggest, greatest thing about the first year with the test species. We proved we know how to do it. We've gotten through all of the issues. We went from catching wild animals to releasing adults. We learned a lot. We figured out several problems. We have solutions for them. That was like great hope. In terms of despair, the biggest thing is when we transition to the Dakota skippers. It's just they are very, very difficult and require even more time and effort than the tawnies require. When we work with those can't be touched with your bare hands. Right now, we can get around a lot of things because we're not working with an endangered species, but we understand that the time commitment is radically going to increase. And then another thing about collection of endangered species is you need to have proof that the numbers are sufficiently strong in the area such that you don't have to, that you're taking them is not going to immediately damage them. So for Dakotas, the number is 50. So you have to see 50 individuals out in the field before you can even start to take individuals. So I want you to imagine you're in a big, wonderful, multi-acre, beautiful prairie, and you're walking around, you're looking for a butterfly about an inch in size, and the best way to find it is to look at the top of coneflowers and look and see if they're just sitting on the top of the coneflowers. And you have to find 50 of them in one site, and you've got about 2 days to do it because you need to move on to another site. And if you don't do it, you can't take any butterflies with you. That's probably the final big hurdle that's in front of our program here that still causes some level of like trepidation. That's going to be a big one. That's going to be a hard one to get over, but we've persevered and gotten through all of the rest of them. So I'm firmly confident we're going to get through it, but
the existence, the thriving of the Dakota skipper, what does it matter? What's at stake here if we lose something like this species?
That's a great question. Tiny butterfly, why do we care, right? Not only are these specific to our area, right? South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, a little bit of Iowa, but South Dakota itself is the home of the most remaining tall grass prairie that there is. Tall grass prairie and Dakota skippers go hand in hand. These guys are a huge, huge part of the food chain. If you think about it, if you don't have the little guys at the bottom, it's hard to scale up. And so you take out a chink of that chain and you can start to see a collapse. But also, you take out the animals and you're also going to see continued collapse of that tall grass prairie. And so you want to save these ecosystems because there's very little of it left in the entire world. Over 75% of tall grass prairies are completely gone. And it's something that I think means a lot to us as people, for me, from South Dakota. And it's going to draw people here in the future. But also, preserving any animal, I think, is always worth it because I want to be able to someday show my kids these butterflies and say, I helped keep these around. You know, I want to be able to say, I helped with this and not have to say, when I was younger, there were lots of these butterflies around. And I think the nostalgia, the emotional piece, I do think that's important too. I don't think we can overlook that as scientists.
Yeah, so the biggest reason that this is super important is that this used to be an incredibly common species of butterfly. The Powashik, the Dakota, and all of our skippers used to be very common butterflies that everybody would see constantly, and their populations overall have collapsed. They've had a lot of difficulty. A big part of it is that 1 year lifespan where if something goes wrong, it's over for them. They don't get a second chance. It should give us some pride here in South Dakota to try and keep our namesake Dakota skipper around and try and keep something that's so deep and important to us, all of that beautiful prairie, as healthy and as vibrant as possible. Every animal we lose from the prairie is an animal that's not gonna come back, right? And every time that happens, the prairie goes further and further away from us.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It's a fish that lived in the same time period as Tyrannosaurus rex, and it hasn't changed its appearance all that much. The pallid sturgeon is a giant of South Dakota's waterways. It grows up to 6 feet long, weighs up to 80 pounds, and lives close to 80 years.
Some of the older ones, like I said, I believe our older ones are, we have some 97s, year class, so that would put them at about 27 years old.
That's how old I am.
That's old. So they were spawned in captivity about when you were born.
That is hatchery biologist Jason Ilgen showing producer Ellen Kester one of the larger fish in the Gavin's Point National Fish Hatchery near Yankton. Jason Krall is a fisheries biologist at the dam, and he does most of his work monitoring sturgeons in the wild. He says it's incredibly rare to pull a wild pallid sturgeon out of the Missouri River these days. Almost all of them have been through hatcheries and through the skilled hands of South Dakota scientists.
Right now, the current numbers of wild fish can be, the estimates they have are anywhere from 500 to just a couple thousand in an entire Missouri River, which is not very much considering what they used to be pre-dam. I mean, they could travel up and down the whole entire stretch of the Missouri River. Back in, I think it was 1937, they put in the first dam up in Fort Peck. And then in the 40s and 50s, they put five other main stem reservoirs, which really hurt the pallid sturgeon. They thrive in water that I guess is very turbid, which looks more like chocolate milk. And now with the dams, all the sediment is trapped and in the reservoirs. So the water coming through all the dams looks more like drinking water. It's very clear. And pallids do not do well in clear water. They have small eyes, they use their barbels like catfish to sense their prey so they can sneak up on them. They don't have any teeth, they just have a suction cup of a mouth that they suck their fish prey off the bottom. So now that the water's clear, it's better for sight feeding fish, for like a walleye or a bass that's, you know, can spot their prey. So when the dams went in, all the prey species that the sturgeon used to feed on, we were getting eat up by walleyes, northerns, bass, all that. And they said pre-dam, the flathead chub used to make up like 95% of the catch when biologists go out in Missouri. And right now, it makes up less than 1%. Wow. I mean, the chub species disappeared along with the pallids pretty much. So some of the other reasons that the pallid has, the population has declined, like I said, they used to move up and down the entire Missouri. They travel hundreds, if not thousands of miles up and down. Now their migration routes blocked by the dams. The water is clear, the water temperature is different. That makes another big difference, like a Fort Peck, Owyhee, Fort Randall, all that water is bottom release. So the water coming through the dam, a lot of it's coming from 120 feet down, which is colder. So the water temperature is colder, which affects the spawning time frame and also the development of the eggs and the embryos.
Can you find these fish in the wild at all anymore?
So back in 2018, there was other questions that were coming about the biologists and the spawning of the pallids. Like, they're trying to figure out where they spawn, when they spawn, if they're spawning. They're trying to find out where that bottleneck is in their population, like what part of their life cycle that they're not completing, and why they're not repopulating themselves, why they don't have a self-sustaining population out there. So back in 2018, we started tagging. We were putting an acoustic tag in the adult pallids. So we probably have almost 300 pallids from Gavin's Point Dam here down to St. Louis that are tagged, and we go out tracking them every day. So today I'm actually going out to do some reassessment. So every fall we have to go back out and capture the adult fish that we believe are going to be reproductive the following spring. We will locate them, and then once we locate them, we'll drift a trammel net, capture them, bring them on the boat. We'll do a length and weight, and then we actually do an ultrasound on them. We have a tub with water, we flip them upside down, and I have an ultrasound machine. And we just go across their belly, and then we can see if they're reproductive or not, and then male or female.
What does recovery look like?
Recovery is a very slow process. So like we were saying, these fish can live up to 80 years old, and they don't spawn. The females don't spawn until they're 14 to 18 years old, and they spawn every other to every 3 years, where males can be like probably 10 to 12 years before they come reproductive. But with such a slow growing species, there's no quick answers. That's the hardest part of this project and the recovery of the pallid.
So one part of Jason Krall's job is to pass those river caught fish off to Jason Ilgen. He's a hatchery biologist, and part of his job is to harvest eggs from pallid sturgeon females and get them fertilized.
Pallid sturgeon are just difficult from top to bottom, especially with spawning. Like, if you were to compare them to a salmonid, which you can just grab a female and you squeeze all the eggs and you're done, right? So a female pallid sturgeon has a Mullerian duct. It's a special pouch, ventrally kind of down the sides, kind of a Y-shaped duct. And that has to fill fully by swimming motion of the fish, and also it's aided by cilia that are in this Mullerian duct. So as these eggs ripen and loosen out of the skein or the egg sac, they get worked down this Mullerian duct. That once that's filled, the fish is done filling it, and it might take generally about 90 minutes in between times of filling that duct. We'll then grab the fish, squeeze that Mullerian duct out, and express the eggs out into a bowl. Quick look at the quality of the eggs, whether they're fit to be fertilized. And then we take the milt from pre-collected off the male the day prior, and we'll use a portion of that, quick fertilize. Add a little water that activates the milt, makes it become active. And it's viable for about 2 minutes after activating with water. And that also starts a process. So you have a germinal pore open on the egg that only allows one and one only sperm in. And once that's in water, you have a finite amount of time to get that egg fertilized. So it's all water activated. Once you do that, you stir it up. Now with that ovarian duct, this process could be repeated from 5 to up to 9 times of this. Take the eggs, pick up the female, squeeze out the eggs in a bowl, fertilize. That process depends on how fast she loads that Mullerian duct. It can be an all-day spawning event. Generally, we're done in about 8 hours to spawn one female. And we might have 3 females going that day, so we just alternate and go round robin. All the fish are very unique from each other. They all have different spawning behaviors. They all ripen up and kind of little different levels of activity, so it's always a surprise. You think, oh, they're all sturgeon, they're all the same, but they're very much unique individuals, and they all will display little variance in behavior and stuff like that.
Now, here's a bit more with Jason Krall.
How do you measure success in your job?
That's one of the hardest things and the question we get asked most, because a lot of the other fish species, like a walleye, you can do a 2-year study, get your answer, and you know, move on. Well, these pallids, we're talking like 10 to 20 year studies to get the same answers about why they're not spawning or why they are spawning and why they're not successful in it. So it's a very slow process, but it is worth it.
What's our role in this? Or is it just understanding what you're doing and staying out of your way? Or is there some way that South Dakotans support this kind of work and this kind of science?
The pallid sturgeon lets us know how well the river is doing. It's one of the indicator species out there, one of the bigger species in the river. So if the pallids are doing well, the river's doing well. And right now the pallids aren't doing well and the river's not doing well in terms of where it used to be. I mean, you can look at it and everybody loves the boating, you know, going up on the reservoirs. But at the same time, that reservoirs have really hurt a lot of the native fish species of the Missouri River. Whether we can help them adapt to this huge change in their life is yet to be seen, but we, you know, the biologists and everybody, we're going to try to figure out what's going wrong, what part of their life cycle they're not successful at, to try to help this species not go extinct.